And now I have the great pleasure and honor to introduce our speaker of today. And as we approach Social Justice Day, Peter Gilmer brings us an update on the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry. Peter is a longtime social justice advocate who has worked with the Anti-Poverty Ministry for many years. Peter brings over 30 years of experience in advocacy, social justice, and human services. He attempts to mediate conflict between individuals and institutions with the view to reaching mutually agreed upon resolutions, while also representing clients through the appeal process, which are in place to resolve conflicts. Peter.
So I want to thank you for this opportunity to speak to you about the Regina Anti-Poverty Ministry, giving a bit of an update as to the key issues that we're focused on these days. But I am going to begin with a little bit of a backgrounder about who we are and our history. I should also mention that we have some supplementary, I have some supplementary materials that are, I brought along. Our most recent annual report is on the back table, and a pamphlet that we've been using for promotional, purposes. However, the same information can also be found on our website, which is at antipovertyministry.ca. So the Anti-Poverty Ministry actually has a fairly long history. We go back to 1971, so close to 53 years now. And it began as the Regina Downtown Chaplaincy, which under the very effective and committed leadership of the Reverend Bob Gay helped to serve the needs of low-income people in Regina and area for almost 25 years from 1971 to 1995. In 1996, which was the United Nations International Year for the Eradication of Poverty, we changed our name and our constitution to kind of better express changes that had taken place in the chaplaincy in recent years as we had moved to being primarily an advocacy, education, and social justice ministry. And we are identified as a social justice ministry of Living Skies region of the United Church. So we're actually no longer in our terms of our lines of accountability. We're actually part of the province-wide United Church. That's who we are accountable to. What used to be Saskatchewan Conference, but now with changes in the church is now Living Skies Regional Council. And that's appropriate in many ways because our work is very much at a provincial as well as a municipal level. Many of the issues that we deal with are based on provincial policy, particularly the policies of income security in social services. And because of the loss of welfare rights groups across the province, and I should mention that when I started connecting myself to this type of work in the late 1980s, there was actually 8 agencies in place that did welfare rights advocacy work. At present, there's 3, and we're really the only one that has a province-wide mandate at present. So there has been a real loss in service in terms of client difficulty dealing with income security, which at present falls under the Saskatchewan Income Support Program and the Saskatchewan Assured Income for Disability. So while our work is focused in 3 areas, casework advocacy, public education on poverty issues, and social justice to work for systemic change, we have been forced, unfortunately, to focus much of our time and energies on casework advocacy just because of the growth of that caseload. And one example I would give is that when the first year I was with the ministry in 1996, our office handled 450 cases for the year. The past 2 years, since 2008, we've always been over 2,000 cases per year. And for the last 2 years, we've been in the 2,500 range, which is really beyond our capacity. We have a two-member staff. staff, myself and Colleen Taylor, who has been with the ministry for the past 2 years, bringing 30 years of social movement and human services experience with her. She came in when Bonnie Morton, my longtime coworker before that, retired at the end of 2021. Bonnie had been with the chaplaincy and then the ministry for 34 years. So yeah, that was really 34 years of exceptional service. But we do have a limited staffing component, which keeps us very busy. We work for a board which is appointed by Living Skies Regional Council. It has to be, as a United Church ministry, we have to have 50% plus one of our board members as United Church members or adherents, but we also have set aside designations for people who come from other faith groups and denominations, come from community organizations working on poverty issues, and perhaps most importantly, people, what we describe as first voice volunteers, folks who have present lived experience in poverty. As an anti-poverty organization, we feel it's very important to have that voice at the decision-making table. Now, in terms of what we've been seeing and what we've been focused on lately, and this is true both in our casework advocacy and our social justice advocacy, is that since 2019, there has been a program in place called the Saskatchewan Income Support Program. In 2021, it completely replaced the old social assistance programs for people who had yet to be identified with significant and enduring disabilities. So the Saskatchewan Assistance Plan, which had been around since 1966, and the Transitional Employment Allowance, which had been around since 2003, were both replaced by the Saskatchewan Income Support Program. And there's many problems with the SIS program, but the biggest one that we saw right off the bat was that it doesn't cover the actual cost of basic utilities. They painted it as providing slightly better benefits than the old Saskatchewan Assistance Plan, but what was deceptive about that is that it wraps power, energy, water, and basic telephone into a very inadequate shelter allowance that people have to pay all their utilities out of. And we knew right off the bat that this was going to cause problems in other areas in regard to being able to maintain rental accommodations in order to have any food security. But certainly the issue of utility cutoffs and arrears we have seen as the biggest growth in our casework over the last couple of years. And this was identified as well by the provincial auditor in her statements back in this past June, where she identified that there were 5,200 households or people on case file that found themselves in very significant utility arrears, and many people who've actually been cut off altogether. Now, one of the reasons that this ties into the houselessness question is that not only does it mean that there's limited amounts to cover off the cost of rent and a growth in evictions based on that, but in order to maintain your accommodations, you have to be able to maintain your utilities. And if you're evicted because you have not been able to maintain your utilities, being able to access a new place is equally difficult. And within the SIS program, unlike the traditional social assistance program and unlike the SED program, along with not being able to provide the actual costs, they can't even provide on a one-time basis an emergency arrears coverage, which would then, like for social assistance and SED, it would ultimately be put on a client's as an overpayment on the client file, but so the client would ultimately still be held responsible, but it would be paid off over time. But there isn't even that provision within the SIS program. So that's meant a considerable number of crises both in relation to rent and utilities. And part of this is also based on the basic adequacy question. The amount that people receive on the SIS program for all their non-shelter-related needs, so food, clothing, personal and household items, and transportation, transportation is only $345 a month. And many people on the program also suffer from having an overpayment on their file for various reasons. So even off the $345, they're getting monies clawed back. What's left in terms of shelter, there's 630 in Regina and Saskatoon and 570 for the rest of the province. But as I mentioned, that shelter allowance not only has to cover your rent or a mortgage, but it also has to cover your power, your energy, your water, and any shelter-related need. So you can start to see why many people on the CIS program have found themselves in a precarious situation in terms of being able to maintain housing and outright homelessness. The other thing I should mention is that the CIS program has very little opportunity for any special needs. The old social assistance program had many of the kind of emergency special needs that the SED program does, things like moving allowances, clothing grants. The only one that the CIS program maintains, and the main one, is a special diet program based on medical confirmation. But there's a whole wide range of special needs that aren't covered on CIS that used to be covered. So when the Minister of Social Services and others say that we're actually doing not too bad in comparison to other provinces across the country, that's the big piece that's being left out, is non-coverage of utilities and not having the opportunity to get any additional special needs. The other thing I would mention is that there's a clawback system with the CIS program, whereby if you need, obviously you need a security deposit or damage deposit when you move into a new place. It used to be that you could get, and on the SED program, you can get a letter of guarantee for the landlord based on your shelter allowance. With the CIS program, if you ask for a security deposit, it can be provided up to the shelter allowance amount, but then it's clawed back at $50 a month until that is paid off. So, you know, as I said, when you're receiving $345 for all your other needs and you're getting clawed back $50 off the top because you've had to move, that's obviously a major problem. But it's not just people on the CIS program that are finding themselves in crisis. Probably a majority of the folks that we're working with are on the Saskatchewan Assured Income for Disability, which, while it does provide slightly better benefits, and it's for people with who've been identified through a disability assessment process as having significant and enduring disabilities, it at present for people in Regina and Saskatoon and what they call Tier A communities, they get $1,094 to cover off all of their, basically both their rent and their other needs, but they are at least allowed a shelter, utility, the actual cost of their base utilities, and there are some options for special needs. So a typical case file in Regina for an individual would be $1,350 per month. So once again, less in rural Saskatchewan. In the Tier 4 or D communities, it's only $931 for those, the combination of those needs. The other thing I should mention is that we all know how much the cost of living has gone up over the course of the last 2 years. But it's actually been eight years from 2015 to last year's provincial budget that the SED program went without a single benefit increase. And during the course of that 8 years, there was also the loss of the rental supplement program or the application process, so people could no longer receive a top-up to cover off their shelter costs. And there was a range of special needs that were cut to the program during that period as well. So people are far worse off today, 9 years later, than they were in 2015, and the program wasn't adequate at that point. presently, of course, the other issue that's very much on people's mind is the houselessness question, which has been at least largely driven by inadequacy in our income security programs, but it's also been as a result of a lack of affordable housing. And we've found that that situation has grown worse recently with the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation report that showed that our vacancy rate in Regina now is 1.4%, 2.4% across the province. CMHC understands a 3% vacancy rate as being a balanced market. But even a few years ago when Regina had a vacancy rate of 7 or 8%, we still had an affordable housing crisis and a crisis in terms of houselessness because people couldn't afford their rent. And that, of course, is the other issue, is a continuation in terms of rental increases. And they're saying that there's been, in the last year alone, there's been an average of $100 increase in rents. So while even during the balance vacancy rate period, we never once saw a decline in rents, they continue to go up. They're once again going back to the speedy increases that they were at 10 to 15 years ago, which is a great concern. And one of the ways that this is usually mitigated would be either ideally a combination of rent controls, which we don't have, and social housing where rent is geared to income. We've never had, and there's been a decline across the board in terms of social housing. However, the frustrating thing for us and for groups across the province has been, and individuals, has been the fact that we have 3,100 vacant SASC housing units at present and 700 in the city of Regina alone. There's a range of rationales that this is the case, but the bottom line is that there isn't a more important funding priority, along with the adequacy of benefits, than making sure that those are brought up to speed, that we can move people into those places as quickly as possible in a period of houselessness and precarious housing for so many. So that's a big short-term, those are some of the big short-term concerns for our ministry. In terms of long-term, I wanted to touch on a couple of key points that have been ongoing for us. Over the years, we've done many consultations and have had poor people's conferences and what we've described as anti-poverty parleys, which have brought together people living in poverty and community groups to talk about what the solutions are and what the key problems are. What's been identified over and over and over again by people is basically six key areas, which are having adequate income security benefits, having a living wage, and mention that we continue to have the lowest minimum wage in the country and have competed consistently for the lowest minimum wage in the country. Quality and affordable housing and child care are three and four. Equity initiatives to ensure that people that have disproportionately borne the brunt of poverty in Saskatchewan, Indigenous peoples, persons with disabilities, lone parent families, persons of color, new Canadians, that we make sure that there's programs in place that we have greater equity in terms of employment opportunities, but also better resource sharing with Indigenous communities and the potential for greater economic development and control. A final key piece is fair taxation. There's no getting around the fact that we can't meet, we can't have adequate income security and housing and child care unless we pay for it. There needs to be the revenues in place, the programming that increases revenues. The reality is that we have a very unfair tax system whereby the top tax bracket for individuals kicks in at roughly $135,000. So whether you made $135,000 last year, $10 million last year, you pay the same rate of income tax. Rather than having a more progressive and basically a more brackets and a more progressive tax system. And of course, getting a very low return on our non-renewable resources has been another big concern. But in terms of these, when we look at these issues, what we find is that they fall within a human rights framework. And we've been part of delegations that have presented to the United Nations Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights to talk about Canada's non-compliance to commitments it's made. And in 1976, Canada, with the approval of all the provinces and the commitment of all the provinces, signed in onto the UN Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. So the policy issues and solutions that have been identified by low-income people and community groups year after year, decade after decade, are not actually just public policy issues. They're basic human rights that Canada and Saskatchewan have committed to under international law. So adequate income security benefits, a living wage, quality and affordable housing and child care are basic human rights. And I want to close, or just kind of, because I know there are folks in this room who have worked with us around guaranteed livable income or universal basic income. This is a position that we have long taken, as has the United Church of Canada, making sure that there's a floor of economic security on which other forms of income can be added. And we're certainly strong supporters of it. However, one of the things, whether we're dealing with the present adequacy question or the long-term need for guaranteed livable income, we believe that it's very important that we have those basic economic rights within legislation. The same way that Medicare has a Canadian Health Act, we believe that social programming and federal and provincial programming need to have that underpinning. So one of the things that we've been calling for is an act to end poverty in Saskatchewan, which would actually put these basic economic rights within enforceable legislation. I want to close by saying that on the door of the Anti-Poverty Ministry, we have a sign that says, "The existence of poverty is shameful. To be poor is not." It's something we also have on our website. Nobody chooses to be poor. It's the result of public policy and economic inequality. It's legislated. But the upside to that, as bad as it is, the upside to that is that if poverty can be legislated as it is, we can end poverty through legislation if we choose as a society to do so. What's needed is the public and ultimately the political will to do that. And that's why we all need to work together to make sure that the political will is in place so that we can make poverty history. So I want to conclude with that, but I do, there's a lot more I could say, but I know that I'd like to open up an opportunity for, I think there's going to be an opportunity for question and answer, so I'd be happy to.
Yes, I was just going to mention that if there's any questions on Zoom, I think we have enough time to do some question and answers today. So I'm going to leave you at the podium, and Joanne will just watch. Okay, yes, and Jim has a mic that he'll walk around and give to anybody that wants to ask a question. So just raise your hand.
I've got a question. Are you aware of the housing initiative that's taking place in Saskatoon with the help of the federal government? Can you comment on that and what prospect we have of something similar happening in Regina?
Well, I know that there has also been a commitment recently in terms of the federal government and the city of Regina. I guess the concern that we have is going to be linked to the affordability piece, because traditionally with a lot of funds that have gone towards affordable housing, they've been put towards development opportunities that were already in the queue, and often not affordable for the people that we work with. And we know in the city of Regina that a lot of the debate over the years is that affordable housing has been identified as at or just below average market rent. And You know, if you're receiving $630 for all your shelter-related needs, average rent is definitely out of the ballpark. That being said, we know that there has been a lot of good grassroots work done, and that Quint Developments and others have put a considerable amount of affordable and social housing on the market. So any new supports is certainly a good thing.
And it seems to me that the federal government has a little more appetite for getting something going than our provincial government does.
I think that's fair game. I think that there's been more monies in terms of, if we look at, even though it's not enough, in terms of pretty much all the money that's come into the city for houselessness initiatives has come from the federal government and very little from the provincial government. And I guess that some of our concerns on that front have been that, you know, it wouldn't be such a big problem if there wasn't such an underfunding of our basic social safety network and social housing programs. But in lieu of that, the fact that there's been virtually no extra money from the province on this is a big concern.
This may be more of an observation than a question. I worked in North Central. I've been retired for, I think, 8 years. And regarding the utilities payments, what I always found quite incredible were the houses that these people were living in. In the winter, the power and electricity became, for a little 600-square-foot house, something that you could pay in a 2,000-square-foot house just because of the insulation, the wiring. And I just don't... I never understood how the government could justify power bills, the amount when that was happening. And also, if the renters complained to the landlords, they eventually would fix them, but then they would increase the rent and then the person would have to leave. So people are often too afraid to even say anything to the landlords about, you know, sewage in the basement or electrical or, yeah. So, yeah, it's quite devastating that people have to live like that.
I guess just very quickly to respond to that, yeah, because having been at this for a while there has always been affordability and to some extent availability questions, even before those were prime issues, we have a long history in this city and in this province of a lot of substandard, ill-maintained properties that are very inefficient in terms of power and heating costs. So one of the things that we've talked about historically is the need for a program that ensured explicit standards for basic standards before occupancy. Now, of course, tenants are already in a very precarious situation in terms of negotiating with landlords. And when we've got as low a vacancy rate again as we do now, that becomes an even tighter issue, more difficult for people to make those negotiations when there isn't a backup plan and there is so much houselessness.
Thank you very much for this. It's really, really interesting and thought-provoking for sure. My question is sort of a superficial question in a way, but I think it's also, well, I think it, I want to know the answer. Yeah. And that is that we used to hear about homelessness and now we hear about houselessness. And I was wondering if there's some reason for doing that that has to do with how you might address, how governments might be asked to address that.
The reason that we've switched to primarily using, and I don't even personally use it exclusively, but the terminology around houselessness is in relation to the fact that Indigenous people are on their homeland, and the idea that it isn't a question of being out of a home, it's not having housing. So, and the connection between colonialism and houselessness at a time when 80% of houseless people are Indigenous or more. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that's part of the reasoning behind that shift. And so we've accepted that, that's grown as a concern in the community, and we've accepted that. I do know in some circles, just because it hasn't picked up yet, I do still use the term homelessness, because it doesn't mean that I have to make that explanation every time I say it.
Yeah, I was assuming that it had to do with encouraging governments to provide more affordable housing, so I was thinking along those lines. Also, though, with an election approaching in Saskatchewan, is there any group that is making really direct efforts to get that on the agenda?
Well, one thing I can tell you, because you have Florence in the row in front of you, I have to mention this, is that our next meeting of End Poverty Regina, that the provincial election strategy is going to be the prime focus. And certainly, you know, some of the issues that we've identified are going to be front and center. And I know that Florence, through the Warm Welcome Coalition and other groups, has been putting forward sort of a draft of calls and facts about poverty in Saskatchewan, but certainly the calls for full coverage for utilities on any income security program is there. The adequacy piece is there, and making sure that we fill those 3,100 vacant housing units, but also a greater commitment to social housing are going to be front and center.
I was just going to say, what the things that your group comes up with in this line, is there a channel to get them to people like our group and so forth so that we're all pretty much on the same page and are more powerful to influence?
Yeah, we'd be happy to get the sort of key points that we're promoting to you. Yeah.
Thank you, Peter. Why is the provincial government leaving those units vacant? They still have to pay taxes on them. What's their underlying motive?
There's a range of possible answers to that. I mean, there's the official answer, which would be that would be a combination of a lot of places not being ready for occupancy, and that there's need for work to go into them to make sure that they can be used. In which case, you know, obviously our response to that would be that then make that happen, make sure that they're brought up to speed quickly. The other thing is the identification of particular forms of social housing. So there's a certain percentage identified for seniors, for families with children, for persons with disabilities, and that the vacancy tends to be more in some areas than others, but that's traditionally the kind of groupings that have been identified. I guess I would say, though, that it is very convenient that the main benefactors of a housing crisis tend to be those in the housing industry that make considerable profit when there isn't a balancing of the market that comes about either through rent controls or through social housing, because that is one of the strengths of a social housing model, is the more affordable housing that you put onto the market, the more it balances out the market across the board. And so there are certainly people that benefit from having a tight vacancy rate and social housing not being used.
Anybody else with any questions? Nope. Well, thank you very much, Peter. I have learned a lot, so thank you.